What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
Introducing the all-new Mazda CX-5, featuring more connection.
Hey Google, where's the nearest Pilates class?
Safety that has your back. More discovery on the scenic routes. More passion in the details. And more control in changing weather. The all-new Mazda CX-5. More to move every side of you. See it in 5 films at MazdaUSA.com/5sides.
Google is a trademark of Google LLC. Sequences shortened and simulated.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Slight hangover from primary election night. It is a mixed bag, but I think it's safe to say that this was a good night for candidates who were endorsed by Donald Trump. Not everybody won. I mean, Madison Cawthorn didn't win. Crazy Lieutenant Governor in Idaho didn't win. But you had a surge of election deniers and conspiracists, including in the governor's race in Pennsylvania. Blue Dog Democrats appear to be headed for extinction. And the Senate race in Pennsylvania is still too close to call on the Republican side. John Fetterman absolutely cruised to victory on the Democratic side. So with all the things that are going on, we are fortunate to be joined by one of my favorite columnist and reporters, Philip Bump from the Washington Post. Philip is the national correspondent for the Post and also writes the Post newsletter, How to Read This Chart. Philip, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, okay. As I said to you before we started this, the only question is, where do we start? I am dying to talk to you about your hour-long conversation with Dinesh D'Souza about his mockumentary or whatever you want to call it. But let's start by what happened in Pennsylvania last night, where you have a full-on conspiracy theorist, election-denying, quasi-insurrectionist named Doug Mastriano, who not only won the Republican primary for governor, but won in a landslide, despite the fact that the Republican leadership was in full-blown panic because they think the guy is actually too crazy to be elected. So just talk to me about the significance of somebody like Doug Mastriano being poised to be the governor of Pennsylvania. At least he's the Republican nominee for governor in one of the most important swing states in the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. There are a lot of factors at play here. I think, you know, from just the straight electoral factor consideration, you know, this is expected to be a strong Republican year. And the question is Mastriano so potentially toxic to purple state voters in Pennsylvania that it even spurs it to be a less overall Republican victory in November simply because Mastriano's at the top of the ticket? I mean, there are, you know, that's the sort of question that I think probably a lot of folks in the party are asking at this point. And I don't know if we know the answer to that. But really, fundamentally, what his victory tells us is something disconcerting, alarming about the extent to which Republican voters are okay with the sort of conspiracy theorizing that Mastriano embraced. You know, that it is not simply the case that they excuse Donald Trump's having, you know, made up lie after lie about the 2020 election. It is not simply the case that they're fine with the fact that Donald Trump tried to, you know, seize a second term in office despite having lost. It is that people who worked with him to try and get that done, who were very explicit in trying to overturn the results of that election, pay no political cost from Republican voters as well. And that, of course, sends a very different and disconcerting message.
Well, you actually wrote yesterday that not only did they not pay a price for it, it turns out that support for the January 6th insurrection is not a barrier in the Republican primary. It might even be a benefit. So, I mean, you know, Mastriano and Kathy Barnett, who fell short, they were actually at the Capitol, and Mastriano came close to the building. And as you know, and far from being disqualifying, there were a lot of voters in the primary who went, right. I mean, this is part of this revisionist history that I'm not sure that everybody's caught up with yet. On January 6th, people are, focused on, well, the evidence, did they actually try to overturn the election? What was going on? While in MAGA world, they are basically saying, damn right, we did it. We're glad we did it. It is a good thing. It was a patriotic uprising.
That's right.
So, you just can't handle the truth.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, January 6th itself has followed a very Trumpian pattern, which is there is an initial response from everybody, including his allies, about what happened. And then over time, in part because of Donald Trump forcefully insisting that what he did was the perfect thing that could have been done, people sort of start coming back along with him. And so we saw that in the wake of January 6th. We saw Republicans, even by the middle of last year, start to be like, hey, you know what? This was not as big a deal as you're making out to be. Democrats are hammering on this for political purposes, yada, yada, yada. And it really became rationalized. And Mastriano, to your point, yes, he got very close to the Capitol. He has talked about having been present when, violence started to erupt. But he also tried to promote an alternate slate of electors in Pennsylvania, which I think from the standpoint of his being the governor of the state is a lot more concerning, because it shows that he's, willing to sort of use the tools of power in state government to advantage someone who lost an election. I think that's its own problem. But really what we're seeing here is that this gets looped into the sense of fighting against the elites. And that's the core energy behind Trumpism, as it always has been. And so now it's not just that January 6th was an attempt to steal an election. It's that January 6th and those who defended Donald Trump in the wake of and on January 6th were simply pushing back against the elites and the media and the Democrats. And that's the sort of fighter we want to see and send to Washington. And I think it's worth noting, too, I mean, at this point, as we talk, the Senate race, the mm-hmm. Republican primary Senate side is not determined. But if you add up the vote between Oz and Barnett, the two Trumpy candidates, they're at about 55%. And, this basically reflects the fact that a majority of people wanted to see a Trumpy candidate on the Senate side as well. And it may just be the case that they split the vote.
Yeah, I think that's a crucial metric for people who want to, parse the results. Is this a repudiation of Donald Trump, or is it a loss for Trump? No, he wins even by losing, by those numbers. And it's also worth noting that, Mastriano is not just your usual Republican denialist. I mean, they've become now a dime or a dozen. This is a guy who's actually been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee because of his role in presenting the alternate bogus state of electors into Pennsylvania. He's also running in a state where the governor appoints the Secretary of State. I mean, here's a guy who has really not made any secret of the fact that if he's in office in 2024, he's fully prepared to use his power and the power of a Republican legislature to overturn the results of an election. I mean, there's no subtlety about it, is there?
There's not. I mean, and we are sort of left in the, again, familiar position of being like, well, maybe he won't be that bad. Right? this has sort of been the last stop on the denial train for, since 2015 is, well, maybe it'll all work out anyway. Right. And we even hear that about January 6th. Well, they didn't actually steal the elections, which is, obviously cool comfort. But, and that certainly is possible. It's also possible he doesn't win, going back to the initial part of this conversation. If you are trying to describe a scenario that is about as bad as it can get for preserving the sanctity of election results in a state, having Doug Mastriano be the governor of your state, I think is pretty close to the worst case.
Yeah, I mean, I actually do at least, temporarily accept the conventional wisdom that that he's going to have some real electability problems. On the other hand, as other people have mentioned this morning, be careful what you wish for. There were a lot of Democrats that felt the same way about Donald Trump back in 2016, mm-hmm. and the environment right now is truly horrible for Democrats. So, this is a test of, can you be so awful, so crazy that you can't win in a wave election, or are waves are waves irresistible? Will there be this the gravitational pull of party loyalty, which we've seen before again and again and again? And it will be interesting to see how the Republican universe out there, whether they get on board with Mastriano, whether or not any of them say, okay, well, he's a bridge too far. I'm skeptical that there will be a, you know, big jailbreak from him, even though, you know, as of last week, most Republicans were saying, this is insane. Our heads are going to explode.
Right. Well, the Republican Governors Association put out a press release last night after he won, you know, supporting his candidacy, which is, you know, the sort of standard GOP establishment lining up behind him. You know, again, that too is also a reflection of sort of the standard past practice we've seen, which is that, you know, partisanship is the primary driver here. You know, that's what parties are for, right? The reason we have parties is to line up behind, you know, members of the party. But that certainly doesn't suggest that the establishment shouldn't be terribly shy about necessarily supporting Mastriano.
Yeah. Well, as you and I are speaking here, we don't know what the outcome of the Senate election, the Senate primary will be. It looks like it's headed for a recount. A little bit of a surprise that Dave McCormick did as well as he did, you know, even though obviously, as if you add up the, you know, the serious MAGA vote, it is more than 55%. Right. Now, of course, he tried to remake himself into a Trumpist. So give me your take on how that played out. It certainly looks like Kathy Barnett, who was like kind of the craziest in the field, might have drawn off some votes from the Trump endorsed candidate, Dr. Oz. Is that the way you're looking at it?
Yeah, it seems that way. This primary is really fascinating. And I don't think a lot of people picked up on this, but it's fascinating because it's as though you took the 2016 Trump and split him into three candidates.
Yeah.
You got the business guy, Dave McCormick. Right. You've got the celebrity guy, Mehmet Oz. And you've got the you know, the just the echoing conservative media play to the base, Kathy Barnett. And so it's sort of interesting that they ended up splitting the vote fairly evenly just because, you know, this is they're all sort of Trumpy in their own way. But yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think if you take Oz or Barnett out of the race, I think that McCormick loses to whoever, you know, remains in. I think that's probably safe to say. And I'm curious what happens if Trump endorses Barnett instead of Oz. You know, does she then very easily win? But, you know, we don't know. You know, it's easy to armchair quarterback.
So going back to what you wrote the other day, maybe it was yesterday, because I think this is an important theme to stick with for a moment. You wrote, in deeply Republican areas, in other words, extremism, far from being an encumbrance, can help candidates gain a political foothold, which leads me to the next thing I wanted to talk with you about, which is the whole controversy about the great replacement theory. And you also pointed out the other day, you know, Elise Stefanik, who was under a lot of fire for actually pushing the racist theory, is not backing off. She's not apologizing. She's going back to the playbook of deny, 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 push back, you know, blame the media. Is this at play with this issue as well? Because on the outside, people are going, well, this is really an embarrassment. This is really, you know, one of those maybe, you know, wake up calls, you know, red flags, and Republicans are going to back away from it. Actually, isn't this the same principle that you're describing, that extremism actually works in Republican primaries, and Elise Stefanik actually understands that?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I mean, I think that, I mean, look at Kevin McCarthy post January 6th, right?
Yeah.
What was it, a week that he was sort of the, you know, we got to do something about this guy, right? Because he very briefly thought maybe this is something which allows us to break out of the cycle of simply being the super extreme party. And then a week later, he realized that it was not going to be a thing. Even that assault on the Capitol was not going to be the thing. Elise Stefanik, as far as I can tell, she didn't even blink. Right. I mean, she was very explicit. This great replacement theory is super useful to Republicans because it allows them to combine a bunch of things as nefarious: immigrants, Democrats. It loops these two things together as sort of working in concert to try and attack normal Americans, which, of course, is generally a proxy for meaning white Americans. So it is toxic and has obvious negative repercussions to communities who are then seen as being, you know, bad actors and nefarious actors. But it is useful in Republican politics. And Elise Stefanik not only elevated this last fall as she was trying to raise money, but in the wake of what happened in Buffalo, doubled down on it. And, you know, again, this is the Donald Trump playbook, which I don't, you know, he didn't originate it, but his playbook was always just simply fight back on everything. And so this is, you know, oh, this is just the media trying to shut me up. And so we just move forward with this very toxic theory.
Well, and I'm sure you've noticed that rather than dial back, I mean, she's not alone in all of this, that, you know, she doubled down. But I'm seeing the same pattern throughout right-wing media, including some of the quote-unquote respectable anti-Trump media, finding ways to rationalize and or turn it around and say they're trying to silence us. We are the victims here.
Right.
And you even have people who are saying, well, actually, you know, weren't Democrats pushing the same replacement theory when they were talking about demographic change, which is one of those logic pretzels that makes my head hurt. But it seems as if, at least right now, it looks like not only are they not backing off the great replacement theory, but we're going to be hearing more about it, that they're going to ride this thing to the end.
Yeah, exactly. That they are trying to make it seem as though the media is casting them as racist when really all they're saying is what Democrats have been saying all along. And we saw Tucker Carlson do this last night. In fact, you know, Tucker Carlson gets on the air and he's like, well, I don't even know what this great replacement theory is, which is his sort of aw shucks, you know, nonsense that he pulls as a rhetorical ploy.
Bullshit.
But then he very quickly was like, well, we do see Democrats talking about how immigration, you know, is advantageous to them politically. And so I actually just have a piece that's about to go up. But the analogy I use is, let's say that you're a farmer and you're worried because you're not getting enough rain. Then all of a sudden there's a rain in the forecast. You're, you know, great. This is what you need. You open up your cistern so you can capture some rainwater and reuse it later. And then your neighbor comes up and says, you made it rain because you wanted this to happen. And you're just like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, no, I understand how this could, you know, might potentially be beneficial to me, but it's not my fault that it's raining. It's just bizarre to me that the party, which spent so long being hyper patriotic about how great America is and the exceptionalism of America and how, you know, how we should be this magnet economically to the rest of the world, now tries to pretend the only reason immigrants come to the United States is because they want to come here and vote in our elections. It's baffling. It's obviously dishonest. It completely misunderstands how long it takes to actually become a citizen as well. But, you know, it is politically useful and therefore it is used.
So a couple of days ago, you wrote, only one part of the Buffalo massacre deviated from right-wing rhetoric. And of course, we always have to be careful about, you know, drawing too direct a line between rhetoric and actual action.
Right.
The responsibility, the blood on the hands is the shooter in Buffalo. But it is striking, the through line from a lot of this great replacement theory rhetoric to the manifesto of the shooter, and a reminder that ideas have consequences, which, as you may know, used to be, that was one of the touchstones of, you know, conservative politics. Ideas have consequences, except this one. So what was the one part of the massacre that deviated from the right-wing rhetoric?
Yeah, right. I mean, that was basically when the trigger was pulled, right? I mean, you have this situation where, and, you know, again, you're right. These are very, very complex things. And this is obviously someone, you know, a lot of people adhere to this great replacement theory, even in very stark and racist terms, who are not then murderers, right? There's something that set this young man allegedly apart. And, you know, we need to acknowledge it. That is absolutely the case. But it is also the case that the things which brought him there in that moment all overlap with things that are being defended, right? The fact that he had access to this rifle, that the New York law, which is very tough on access to guns, nonetheless allowed him to purchase it. The fact that, you know, that the Republicans defend extended magazines, like the one that he illegally modified his rifle to be able to hold. The fact that, you know, he you know, espouses this idea that whites are under threat and that he needs to rise to their defense. And now we're seeing, even after this, you know, as we just discussed, that's being defended. All of these things, you know, I absolutely acknowledge that there is no short-term solution to reducing the availability of guns in the United States that is both politically feasible and or, you know, solves the problem completely. But the fact that all of the things that he did that brought him there are still being defended, with the exception of the moment he pulled the trigger, I think should cause people to do some consideration.
So I want to talk to you a little bit more about this, but also, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, you had an hour-long conversation with Dinesh D'Souza about his new movie, 2000 Mules, which is the Big Lies, big screen debut. And I want to talk to you about that after this. So if you wake up every morning thinking, I wish this bag under my eye would just go away, you're obviously not alone, because bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of American men and women until now. Introducing the new GenuCell serum with plant stem cell technology from Chamonix. Susan from New Jersey wrote, I've been using GenuCell for a couple of months and the puffiness around my eyes is gone. Even the crow's feet and the small lines have disappeared and haven't come back. I love your product. I use it under my eyes, around my cheekbones, and on my eyelids. So not only Susan, folks, I know people who use it and who love it. And with its instant effects, you will see results in the first 12 hours, guaranteed, or your money back. During the Genucel Mother's Day sale, you can save up to 50% off all Genucel products at Genucel.com now. Go to Genucel.com/Bulwark, Genucel.com/Bulwark. Order today, and Shamanex will include a surprise luxury gift absolutely free. Genucel.com/Bulwark, Genucel.com/Bulwark. That's Genucel.com/Bulwark.
Okay, we are back with Philip Bump from the Washington Post. I want to get to 2,000 Mules in a moment. And what I like about your work, Philip, is you really do connect a lot of the dots. So I'm looking at some of the recent columns you wrote. So we're talking about the way that extremism actually helps Republicans in the primary. And I think this relates as well, because you wrote a couple of days ago, Trump's off-the-cuff abortion position moves closer to reality. And I remember this so well. I think it was here in Wisconsin that Donald Trump sat down with Chris Matthews. And Matthews asked him whether or not, in the case of abortion, you know, women should be, you know, held criminally liable as well. And Trump, who clearly had not given 5 minutes thought to the issue at that point, said, well, of course, women need to be held accountable. And, you know, the rest of the pro-life movement pushed back and said, oh, that's terrible. And he backed off. But as you point out, once again, the most extreme position finds a way of sort of popping up like whack-a-mole on the right, playing out right now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the best part, I mean, it's honestly one of my favorite Trump scenes because it was so revelatory, because it wasn't even just, he's like, yes, I think they should. You could see him think about it. Like, you know, a candidate for president just sitting there being like, well, I think that, yeah. And it's just like, come on, man. Just be like, you know what? That's a good question. Let's come back to it.
And what he's thinking is, at that moment, he's thinking, what am I supposed to say? If I was really pro-life, if I was, I am playing a pro-life individual, what would a pro-life individual sound like? And because he really wasn't, he sort of blurts that out.
Right. And you could just hear all the actual pro-life people just going, like, yes, as he did it, right? But it's fascinating. That was a conversation in a world where people presumed Roe was not going anywhere. That's no longer the world. We presume that Roe is going somewhere, that Roe is going to be overturned. And what we see in polling is that actually probably about half of Republicans agree that maybe there should be some sort of criminal penalty for women who seek out an abortion, you know, in places where it's illegal. That is, I mean, that there are obvious political repercussions to that. And that is, I think, something that it will not take long, should Roe be overturned, for Democrats to sort of seize upon. But it's also something that, you know, may start working its way into policy. So far, what we've seen, both trigger laws almost to and trigger laws, of course, being ones that are were already passed. So if Roe is overturned, they'll immediately go into place to ban abortion. Most of the laws in states that have trigger laws actually explicitly exempt women from criminal punishment. They say very explicitly that this is not the case. But we have seen some legislation that's been introduced, which could potentially start seeing criminal punishment for women. And that changes the politics of it. And if we're talking about a situation in which Roe comes down to state level fights, you know, that is potentially something that could reshape what those fights actually look like.
Well, and if people understand the sort of, you know, hold my beer march to the extremes in Republican politics, you can see how that would happen, because the litmus tests and the goalposts, to use all these cliches, you know, keep moving on all and one issue after another. You know, somebody, you know, comes out in favor of a ban on abortions after 15 weeks, and you know, their opponent says, well, no, that's a squishy position. It should only be 6 weeks. And somebody says, well, no, if you really believe that it's the, you know, that it's a human life from conception, then 6 weeks is in fact, you know, indefensible. And there's an iron consistent logic that if, in fact, it is the equivalent of murdering a human being, then why wouldn't you hold the mother accountable? I mean, this is part of the problem, is there is a logical chain there. And if you marry that to this, who is the purest, who is the most extreme in Republican internal politics, you can see how this could happen.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I mean, you really hit on the concern here, which is that we have been in this race to the polls, you know, and the left has been moving to the polls too. You know, the whole debate about Elon Musk, you know, I don't want to both sides here, but I can just anticipate. Right. So the pushback we're going to get, the right was more extreme and has also moved further to the right over the course of the past 8 years or so, particularly in the Trump era. But there is this, especially as we see, you know, more polarized, more nationalized elections, as we see more safe seats in the House, as we see this further alignment of Senate races and presidential races, as we see partisanship play such a bigger role, as we see primaries, you know, becoming more important in terms of determining who actually gets sent to Washington. All of these things contribute and overlap with a conservative media that continues to push people to the right. And so we see, exactly to your point, these arguments over who can be further to the right on this issue. And, you know, again, I don't know how that might muddy what happens politically with some of these fights over abortion that I seem as though they're inevitable.
Okay, so let's circle back to the big lie. We see the potency of the big lie in the primaries last night. And the big lie now has its movie, and you've written about this extensively, and you've talked to the producer. 2000 Mules, you write, offers the least convincing election fraud theory yet. So talk to me about this, because this is a big thing on the right. Donald Trump opened up Mar-a-Lago to have a star-studded debut featuring all kinds of, you know, MAGA heroes like Kyle Rittenhouse, et cetera. So you've watched the movie. What do you mean when you say it's the least convincing election fraud theory yet? I mean, it's a movie. It must be true.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's the least convincing simply because I came into it. You know, I came into it skeptically. I'm not going to say that I came into it fresh faced and, you know, assuming that perhaps, you know, I know who Dinesh D'Souza is. I know his track record. I was skeptical coming into it. Even by that standard, I was surprised at how little evidence there was for the claims that were being made. So essentially the thrust is D'Souza worked with this group called True the Vote, which is a conservative organization from Texas. True the Vote says that they spoke with this whistleblower who says that he was paid $10 for each ballot he returned in Georgia. They then cobbled together this strategy of using cell phone geolocation data, data that your cell phone produces, provides to apps and things along those lines that then is aggregated for marketers, that they used that data then to track people who went to multiple drop boxes. They then obtained video from the drop boxes, and they put together this broad theory that there were thousands of people working across the country to collect ballots and drop them off in drop boxes, and that made the difference in the presidential election. That's the argument. No part of that is demonstrated to be true in the movie. There is no evidence shown for the geolocation data. There is no connection made between the geolocation data and the video snippets that are shown in the movie. In other words, there's no proof that the video snippets even reflect any of these so-called mules. There is, you know, the centerpiece of the movie, because obviously what D'Souza is doing here is he's filling the demand, right? The demand is for someone to prove something that shows that Donald Trump won. Dinesh D'Souza is a smart guy, smart enough to know that he can create a product that fills, that meets that demand and fills his pockets with money. He creates this movie. And so part of the movie shows, you know, here's how, if we assume these mules did what they're doing, here's how many votes this would have overturned. These are illegal votes, and therefore Donald Trump would have won the election. That's the emotional heart of the movie. But this is a really key point that not a lot of people have hit on. It depends on assuming that these mules each deposited an average of 5 ballots each time they went to a drop box. Mm-hmm. And here's the question. How the hell could you know that, right? If you were using geolocation data, there's no way you could know how many ballots they have, right? And in the video snippets, they show one or two people, you know, putting more than one ballot in. Most of the snips they show of these quote-unquote mules, they're only putting one ballot in. So where do you get this 5 from? And I pushed him on that, and he just said, well, you know, they can look at the video and tell. But they don't have video from, he admitted elsewhere in an interview, they don't have video from most of these states and a lot of these drop boxes. There's literally no way you can know that. And if you don't know how many ballots are being deposited, the whole thing goes out the window. But he doesn't care because it makes his argument and it makes some money.
Well, as you point out, it's a religious text for true believers. But, okay, so the ballots that he's talking about, the ballot harvesting, where, you know, people go and they collect other people's votes and they put them in for them, right? I mean, is that fair? Okay. Are these bogus votes or are they real votes?
Yeah, this is the other part of the question. Right?
This is an important aspect of this question, right. I think, you know.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's a couple of important pieces of context here. The first is he's looking at 5 states: Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. In 3 of those states, ballot harvesting is illegal. In 2 of them, it wasn't. Pennsylvania, you're allowed to collect people's ballots and submit them. Yeah. In Wisconsin, there was no law. And so one of the fascinating things is back in March, these folks from True the Vote sat down and they sat before a committee in the legislature for Wisconsin. They made this big case about all this ballot harvesting. And then one of the Democrats in the committee is like, well, of course, but that wasn't illegal in Wisconsin. They're like, well, yeah, no, it wasn't, but blah, blah, blah. Right? And she's like, well, okay, yeah. Well, that's sort of your entire point. But, you know, both True the Vote and Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, where ballot harvesting is illegal, both of them have made the case in that Wisconsin committee, in the case of True the Vote, and Brad Raffensperger in interviews, that just even if these are ballots collected from voters and submitted, that doesn't make them illegal ballots. They're perfectly right. valid ballots. And as such, even if you had these five mystery ballots where this number was pulled out of thin air, if they're, you know, they're legal votes unless proven otherwise. And of course, you know, there's no evidence that they weren't. So these are legal ballots anyway, even if they were collected by these, you know, so-called harvesters.
So, I mean, give me your piece. I mean, you mentioned this scene that's built around the video of a woman using a Dropbox. And as you mentioned, you know, the film claims she, you know, she's sticking three or four ballots into the box and she's wearing, here it comes, latex gloves during the pandemic. And she takes them off after using the ballot box and it's 1 a.m. And we're supposed to believe this is really, really nefarious, that she would be wearing these gloves. What do you think?
Right. So in this scene, they actually show multiple times in the movie. They show it. So he has this thing he does where he goes over the evidence with these folks from True the Vote and this guy named Greg Phillips. And then he shows it to this panel of conservative commentators who, of course, are just stunned and now fully convinced that the election was stolen, which obviously they all believed beforehand anyway. So this incident of this woman depositing this thing, she goes up to the drop box, puts in a ballot, takes off her gloves, throws them in a garbage can, and goes back to her car. And one of the things they focus on intently is, whoa, she didn't even see that garbage can when she walked up, but she knew it was there to throw away her gloves, as though, you know, you can't see things out of the corner of your eye and or see things when you turn around. So D'Souza, when I'm talking to him, he's like, well, one of the things that's been argued is, well, you know, maybe she's doing it for coronavirus. And it's like, well, obviously that's not true because you would still keep wearing your gloves and, you know, back to your car. And I'm just like, well, no, you wouldn't. Like the whole point of wearing gloves is you wear the gloves to protect you when you're touching a common use object. Then you take those off so you don't contaminate your car or touch your face. And it's just like, but... And it's sort of fascinating, both that and this other incident in which he tries to claim that someone taking a picture of a ballot being deposited necessarily means that they were, you know, trying to do it to get paid, just shows a complete lack of understanding of what people who weren't in his bubble were thinking. Like, I don't think Dinesh D'Souza spent a lot of time worrying about coronavirus restrictions, right? I mean, he's very conservative and that tends to be the case. And so he probably never even considered why people might wear gloves to protect themselves against coronavirus and therefore found it very bizarre that you take the gloves off after touching the Dropbox. And it's just, it's easily explained if you're outside of that bubble.
Well, I don't, you just mentioned this, the scene of the guy on the bike dropping off a ballot and he's trying to take a picture of himself while he's at the Dropbox. And of course, D'Souza suggests he's trying to prove that, you know, he's done the trafficking so he can get paid. But as you kind of ignores the social media campaigns of people who are, you know, taking pictures of themselves. I voted. I did all of these things.
Right.
It's this intention to inflate it all. So you actually spoke for about an hour with D'Souza about all of this. Now, I see that he's tweeting this morning. He's noting, you know, all of these news organizations are doing fact checks, pointing out how many misrepresentations, falsehoods there are. And he's saying that he's never enjoyed himself so much. Mm-hmm. So when you talk to him, I mean, is he enjoying himself? Is he kind of proud of this? Is he feeling any sort of chagrin about the kinds of disdain that he's getting from people who are actually taking apart his work? Or I guess what I'm getting at is that the thing about Dinesh D'Souza, he understands that he can feed this to the true believers, he can make lots of money, and that right now in the current environment, he is absolutely immune from any fact-checking. He lives in a world where none of that affects him at all. Is that the sense you get from him?
I think clearly D'Souza is enjoying this moment. I mean, he's getting exactly what he wanted, which is a lot of attention for his film. But I also think he actually believes he's onto something here, right? In having this conversation with him, he has a lot of faith in True the Vote's data and True the Vote's presentations of what's happened. It was very clear in a conversation he had not done a lot of due diligence in assessing the validity of what True the Vote was presenting to him. He had not talked to their whistleblower. There was no indication that he had actually seen the connection that True the Vote purports between their geo-tracking data and these visuals at the drop boxes, which is an absolutely essential part of the case. So, for example, the bike guy that you just mentioned, if that bike guy isn't shown by geolocation data to have been a mule who went to all these other drop boxes, then there's no point in showing him in the film anyway. I challenged him on that, and he couldn't say, beyond taking the word of True the Vote, you know, beyond assuming that the word of the truth of the vote was accurate, that he was actually this bike guy was a mule. And this is really important because the guy who he's relying on for all this is this guy named Greg Phillips. And if you have ever heard of Greg Phillips before, it's because in November 2016, a couple of weeks after the 2016 election, Greg Phillips very publicly stated that he had proof that millions of people voted illegally in the 2016 election. Donald Trump seized on it, amplified it, said, here we go. I was right all along. I won the popular vote. And Phillips presented not one shred of evidence to that point. And everyone forgot about it until he pops up. And it's sort of honestly baffling to me. True the vote would put all their eggs in his basket, his having been proven to be false. And I also think it's worth pointing out, I mentioned this to Susan in our conversation, True the Vote was actually sued by a high-profile donor giving them millions of dollars because he did not see any result of his investment. He did not see them coming forward with any proof of fraud. And then voila, now they have, you know, they're the centerpiece of this big campaign around fraud. So they had a motive directly to please their funders to try and come up with some evidence that fraud occurred. And they're having the person who was saying that fraud occurred is a guy who was in the past made similar claims while presenting no evidence. And all of that, those are the people that Dinesh D'Souza is willing to say, you know what, I bet they're right and they're presenting this fairly. And I think those are all bad assumptions all the way down.
Yeah, well, you know, Dinesh has made a series of bad assumptions. By the way, this is just sort of a digression here. You know, at The Bulwark, we published a review by my colleague Amanda Carpenter. And Dinesh D'Souza's response was to make fun of her because she had gone to a state school, right, as opposed to an Ivy League school like Dartmouth, which I thought was awfully interesting, you know, a convicted felon mocking somebody for their resume, but also this new populism, this new anti-elitism, making fun of somebody who went to Ball State as opposed to Harvard, Yale, or Dartmouth. It's sort of, I mean, Dinesh is, what can I say? He's a piece of work. But so why?
can I just make, a point, please, on that? Because look, here's the thing. There's also a sexist aspect to it too. Guess where I went to college? I went to the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. You know what? He didn't mention that in any of the conversations that we had. So, I feel like there's something else at play here.
There probably is, of course. Yes. And so he hasn't lashed out at you for what you have written because you went to a state school.
Correct. Because I'm some ignorant, you know, hick from Ohio. That's right.
Yeah. It just seemed like a bizarre flex on his part. So why did he talk to you, do you think? I'm always interested in guys who take the phone calls from guys that they know are not going to, you know, I mean, he's comfortable in the Newsmax OAN bubble. He's apparently been exiled by Fox News. He's very mad at Fox News for not hyping it. But he talked to you, Philip.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the first is that he did the very standard, you know, smart guy on the right tactic of, as soon as I started criticizing 2000 Mules, he very publicly was like, okay, then why don't we debate it? And so, you know, I am wise enough to know that, you know, debates do not offer an opportunity for actual, you know, real conversation because you can't back up what you're saying with facts and so on and so forth. But I said, you know what? Yeah, absolutely. Let's have a conversation. And so I think to some extent he'd painted himself into a bit of a corner, especially because I kept egging him on and being like, hey, come on, man. I thought we were doing this, because he sort of went radio silent after I said, yeah, let's do it. So we had this conversation. I think that's part of it. But I think he also recognizes that, you know, having more attention in the Washington Post and getting to, you know, pit the Washington Post as his opponent benefits him both broadly and specifically in trying to sell the movie. You know, I'm not, you know, my goal here is not to have more people watch 2000 Mules, since it's obviously a bit of wildly misleading propaganda, but I do think it's worth establishing for the record the ways in which he very clearly is not able to defend the claims that he presents in the film.
Yeah. So let's talk about another one of the interesting developments over the last 24 hours, the defeat of Madison Cawthorn in the primary. Now, I have to confess, I've written a lot about Madison Cawthorn. We have dunked on him frequently, you know, held him up as an example of being deplorable. I have to admit that having read that Politico profile over the weekend, you really got the sense of how badly damaged and broken and just totally fucked up this guy is. So give me your take on the fact that Republican primary voters decided to move on from Madison Cawthorn, whether we should read anything into it.
I mean, I can't remember a time in which the party has turned so viciously against one of their members, right? You know, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. People like to point to the cocaine orgies thing, which I don't think a lot of people have sort of, you know, speculated that with excitement that perhaps that's because he was telling the truth. I think it's more just because it showed that he was totally detached from any commitment to the party anyway. So they wanted to get someone in line, you know, but he didn't want the job. Like, he liked the idea of campaigning. He liked the idea of being a Congress member. But when he came to Washington, he immediately said, well, I'm not going to focus on policy. I'm going to staff up my comms team instead. He wanted to sort of be a personality. And he became a personality, but he didn't want to be a member of Congress. And, you know, I don't know if he could have saved his seat if he'd really fought for it, but I'm not sure he wanted to fight for it. But yeah, I mean, look, you know, when you're 26, you feel like an adult, and you and I old enough know that you're sort of not. And,
right.
You know, I don't mean to disparage anyone saying that, but like he has some growing to do. And I think he got in way over his head.
I think so.
And sort of stepped onto the national stage and wilted under the lights. And was already coming to that position. He was trying to prove something to himself. And look, I don't want to play armchair psychologist too much, but you know, it certainly does seem as though, you know, he was facing a very challenging position in his life. This gave him some validity, but then he didn't really consider what the downside of that would be. And now he sees. And you know, I sincerely wish him the best. I think that, you know, he has a lot of challenges he needs to overcome, but I think Congress probably was not the right place for him.
No, in many ways, it just it magnified all of the problems that he had. But even with all of that, even calling Vladimir Zelensky a thug and his conduct and the videos, etc., he still got 31.9% of the vote. He came very, very close to winning. And, you know, one of the big questions is, you know, even with Donald Trump's support, even in this post-shame MAGA world, you know, is there a bridge too far? And, you know, you could point at Madison Cawthorn as being an example, although the Republican Party, it does feel like the Republican Party really coalesced to get rid of him, but only did so barely. And I'm wondering, you know, the Eric Reitens of the world sitting in Missouri mm-hmm. going, okay, you know, that's not that bad. You know, I tied up a woman and took pictures of her and, you know, was forced to resign in disgrace as governor. But, you know, new times, new rules. You know, I guess I'm saying that I don't think people should have any sort of irrational exuberance that, okay, now here's a sign the Republican Party is healing itself because they've thrown out Madison Cawthorn.
Yeah, I think to reinforce that point, the reason that one might presume he lost, and obviously we're making presumptions here, one might presume he lost because these videos came out, because he, you know, was driving without a license, because he's bringing guns to airports, because he was making all sorts of dumb 26-year-old decisions, not because he, you know, was armed on the floor of the House and because he, you know, voted to overturn the election and because he was a stalwart supporter of Trump and because he, you know, badmouthed Zelensky, right? Like, I don't think those things affected his election outcome. I think it was the videotapes and the constant fodder for stories about his behavior. And so if you are trying to extend Cawthorn's loss into some broader lesson about, you know, maybe Republicans have had enough of Trumpian style politics, I think you're wildly misreading the rationale behind his defeat.
Well, I think, you know, since it's been somewhat dark, we should point out some relatively maybe, you know, we're grasping here, you know, positive developments. The governor of Idaho, Brad Little, beat the insane Trump-endorsed lieutenant governor, Janice McGeachin. Is that how you pronounced it?
Yeah.
And apparently in Idaho, the Republicans also nominated a perfectly sane individual over two Stop the Steal lunatics in another race. So
the Secretary of State, yeah.
Yeah, Secretary of State. So in some ways, it is a mixed bag. But I think anybody looking at these results and thinking that Republican Party is prepared to move on with MAGA would be engaging in some rather aggressive wish casting.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we also need to be careful of, and, you know, the Idaho races were interesting. I think that the Secretary of State's race probably had some split the vote sort of style. I mean, you know, the guy who won that race did so fairly narrowly. I mean, this is still early. And I think McEachin was just sort of, she's the person who people may remember. As soon as the governor left town for a conference or something, she was acting governor and passed all these crazy executive orders. And the governor came back and was like, what the hell are you doing? And they had to undo them. And so, you know, so she was also sort of acting against the guy who they'd elected in the first place, which I think probably didn't really help her. But all that said, I think we're going to see Trump crowing about how well he's doing, because that's what he does. And, you know, he bases his power on these sorts of endorsements. And I really think it's important to remember, as we see that happen, that not only is Trump, of course, simply trying to validate his own power, not really trying to make real statements about what's happening in American politics, but, you know, things like if he tries to take credit for Mastriano, if he tries to, like, downplay, you know, what happened with Cawthorn. He endorsed Mastriano, what, last Friday, was it? After it was obvious he was already going to win, and because he was worried that Barnett was going to beat Oz, and so he wanted to split the difference in Pennsylvania. Like, I think one thing to remember is that for a very mixed picture of what happened in Republican politics, it is not the case that Donald Trump is uniformly a winner, which is, of course, the case that Donald Trump's going to try and present.
Philip Bump, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Philip is the national correspondent for The Washington Post, also writes the Post newsletter, How to Read This Chart. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow to do this all over again.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, is it just me or does it feel like nothing is actually what it says it is anymore?
Yeah, like when you order chicken fingers, you don't get fingers, you get mystery nuggets.
Exactly. Well, except Hotels.com.
I was going to say, yeah. Hotels.com, because they do hotels.
Refreshing.
And when booked as a member, rewards are earned every stay. Not points that disappear, rewards that work like cash and can actually be used.
So the name checks out and the perks do too.
Yep. Members can get up to 20% off tons of hotels with no blackout dates. Just works with real travel.
Okay, that tracks.
Hotels.com, it's all in the name.
Al llegar a los 50, ya había aprendido algunas cosas, como el valor de la familia, la importancia del trabajo y que el 99% de las personas de más de 50 ya tienen el virus que causa la culebrilla. Aunque no todas las personas en riesgo la desarrollarán, yo sí la sufrí. La erupción dolorosa con ampollas duró semanas, haciendo que incluso las tareas más simples sean todo un reto. No aprendas sobre la culebrilla de la manera difícil. Habla hoy con tu doctor o farmacéutico. Patrocinado por GSK.